ABC Listen. Podcasts, radio, news, music, and more.
You're listening to The Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Hi there, happy Monday. Selena Green again with you for all this week. Now, the election's done and dusted, but we're not quite done talking about it just yet. Today you'll hear from some ag industry groups for their thoughts on the result and what it could mean for Australian farmers and agriculture going forward. How are you feeling about the result? What do you want to see from the re-elected Albanese Labor government for agriculture into the next term? My talkback number today, 1300 160 222. Or if you want to share your thoughts via text, this is the number to send it to, 0467 922 783. Also today, the call is out across South Australia, and the call is Save Our Sheep.
How many numbers we're actually looking at as to how, you know, how many sheep we need to feed before the season breaks and before that feed actually comes through, which, you know, is now looking into June by the look of it.
I'll come back to that story in this next hour. You'll find out more about what that campaign is about, what it aims to achieve later on in the program. But first today, there's a landslide win for the Labor government during the weekend's election, confirming the end of live export trade for sheep and offering stability in terms of trade negotiations for Australian farmers. ABC's Warwick Long spoke with the president of the National Farmers Federation, David Johinke, about the result and the path forward.
Well, first of all, I think there'll be some bookies out of coin. I don't think anyone expected to see the result to the extent that what we did. And it does now put on a fair bit of focus with regards to what they believe they have a mandate on and what's a good outcome for agriculture. And we have got some policies that we definitely align in, and there's going to be some absolute headwinds, especially around when we talk water, industrial relations, trade with regards to the sheep live export, and also when we talk about productivity with regards to making sure we're not getting more burdenous legislation that can potentially hold us back.
Is this the end of live export of sheep?
Well, it's going to be a real challenge from here. It was a challenge beforehand, but we're going to have to regroup and rethink our strategy on this one.
Labor promised it was going to phase it out. The phase-out time will happen in this term of government. So no matter what, the industry ends, doesn't it? And once it ends, is it ever coming back?
Because it's legislated, it needs to go through both houses to be repealed. So whichever way this shakes out, we still have a strong desire for this trade to stay open. It is still key for a lot of how agriculture is structured in the West. And we have to also recognise that if we're talking about animal welfare, by removing yourself, it doesn't remove the trade. So once again, a lot of challenges in that space.
Is it going to be hard for the National Farmers Federation dealing with this government, given when you came into this role, you effectively declared war on the government's position in a number of ways? The NFF held a national protest against the government and its policies on the lawns of Parliament House. Are they going to listen to you?
Well, we have to make sure that we hold firm on ag policy, and we're not going to back away from what we call hard lines that we put in the sand around what we can and can't accept. We'll obviously still be making sure we can use as much diplomacy as possible when we do advocate. We still have excellent access, and even on the day of the rally, we had a meeting with the Prime Minister to put forward our case on numerous issues. So I think as long as we're respectful and can always attack the policy and try to not get involved in the politics, that's always going to solve a lot of disputes that we have. But ultimately, there will be some policies that we're not satisfied with, and we'll take appropriate action to demonstrate that. I always see every parliament being a new parliament, a new fresh start to both re-establish what we see as good policy, but also it does give us a fuller understanding of where they believe they want to go for the next term as well.
It's part of the difficulty going to be for you working with this new government, getting your own house in order with state farming organisations wanting to resign at the moment, and the government itself being able to go to other farming groups like Farmers for Climate Action, which is part of the National Farmers Federation but still has its own meeting with governments, or other groups to pitch forward its case and say it has the support of farmers?
Oh, look, obviously, like any organisations that are involved in advocacy, we go through growing pains, and we're just going through another cycle of that at the National Farmers. And we want to have a lot of the pinch points resolved before the year's end. We've got a whole process in train now to resolve a lot of issues around either funding mechanisms and the amount that people can afford, let alone then the way that representation and policies develop. So we'll have some pretty huge announcements hopefully in the near future, and we've got a members council coming up in the next 2 weeks that will bring to a head a lot of the issues that are causing angst between a membership. So hopefully we'll have all of that in train, which then makes us unified and get us back on focus on delivering better policies for farmers.
That's David Johinki speaking there. He is the president of the National Farmers Federation, speaking with Warwick Long. Well, let's bring it back a little closer to home and back to South Australia now, and what another term of the Albanese Labor government could mean for the state's grain growers. Joining me is Brad Perry, who's the CEO of Grain Producers South Australia. Good afternoon. Thanks for your time.
Good to be here, Selena.
So is it clear, based on the election process we've just gone through, very fast, frantic 5 weeks, but what farmers should and can expect from this re-elected Labor government? Is the ag platform crystal clear?
Oh, look, I think it's going to be a bit of a work in, pardon me, a bit of a work in progress, Selena. We know that obviously they've been there for, federal government's been there for a term already, and there's a number of things that we'll need to continue to work with them on. I think that the most positive thing that can come out of it is at the moment we've got a state Labor government and a federal Labor government, so hopefully they can continue to work together and we can get some strong outcomes going forward.
Imagine things perhaps like drought policy, that coordination across state and federal. Is that something that you would like to look for?
Yeah, that's right. And that's one of the challenges at the moment with having the government in caretaker mode. So hopefully now we can get on with continuing to have those conversations, not only that we're having with the federal department on drought support for South Australia, but also the new federal agriculture minister. And, you know, I know you were just playing David Johinki's interview as well, and the NFF has supported our call for the new ag minister to come down and visit South Australia in drought pretty much straight away. So we'll be continuing to put that request in.
A lot of the concerns that we've heard in the lead up to this election are around input costs, red tape, increasing hoops for producers to jump through, things like carbon accounting. Will those sorts of things be the focus of advocacy for grain now that the matter of government is settled?
Oh, well, certainly. Look, and they were the focus beforehand anyway. We've been working with our national body, Grain Producers Australia, and also Grain Growers Limited and the NFF, all at a national level, on trying to look for solutions and advocate on those important issues. I mean, number one here at the moment for us is obviously the drought, but input costs and just the general costs of doing business, supply chain improvements, access to markets, biosecurity. All these things don't go away, and so we need to continue to push for positive policies and investment in those areas. You know, I think one of the missed opportunities is more investment in regional roads, you know, not only for regional communities, but for agriculture and grain as well. So we're hoping that we can continue to work with the state Labor and federal Labor government to get some investment in that area. And on the opportunity side, there's obviously the national food security strategy too. So we want to make sure that there's some national, some outcomes from that can impact not only nationally, but at a state level as well.
Yeah, I did want to ask you about that. A $3.5 million commitment from Labor to develop a future national food security strategy, Feeding Australia, and that includes establishing a national food council. Do you see some benefits in this for the grains industry?
Oh, certainly. Look, I think food security is critical. There's no doubt about that. And what we've seen with international markets is that a lot of them are actually trying to grow produce for their population instead of importing. So we're sort of coming into to a bit of a strange cycle after COVID where There's a lot, seems to be a lot less reliance on exports. So I think we do need to look at our national food security and where that sits, and have some plans going forward into the future. Grain is a massive part of that. You know, we're a huge economic contributor to South Australia's economy and the national economy. I think we've just got to make sure that there are some tangible outcomes from it as well.
Speaking to Brad Perry from Grain Producers South Australia today, because in the past few years there have been a lot of choppy waters in trade. There's been agreements signed, work in that space to reopen China. How important is it to have some stability and a steady hand on keeping those various markets open for our grain producers?
Yeah, look, that is another positive, I think, of the election result, is there is some continuing relationships that will be there from an international market access point of view. I mean, from a grain perspective in South Australia, you know, we're majority exports, so our entire industry is relying on our crops being sold overseas. So we need that income, we rely on it, we need really strong relationships in that area. So we're hoping that you know, there is a little bit of a rough sea at the moment in some countries. So hopefully a bit of stability can help from a food grain market point of view.
Brad Perry, thanks for your time on the Country Hour today.
No worries.
Brad Perry there, the CEO of Grain Producers South Australia, which takes us to 16 minutes past 12.
You voted and had your say in the federal election. Now the ABC has the full results.
For the latest on the election and what it means for you, head to ABC News Online.
Go to abc.net.au/AustraliaVotes or download the ABC News app.
You're listening to the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
One text that's just come through on the text line. This one's from Dan. Hi, Dan. Thanks for your text. Dan's using this text number. It's 0467922783. Dan says in his text, unfortunately expecting more of the same, but with no effective opposition, the ALP will push its policy agenda unhindered. Numerous promises will undoubtedly be broken given Albanese's track record and will continue to be worse off, feels Dan. He says, to say I'm disappointed with the outcome is a massive understatement. P.S., he says, it's a pretty crap day out here, dry seeding, but it will rain again and get the season back on track. Yep, it will rain, Dan. It will come at some time. So, yeah, hang in there. But imagine it's pretty windy today and a hot one as well across many parts of the state. So not a nice one out there. We will check in with the Weather Bureau as well very, very shortly. But first, let's talk about what's going on in the Australian wool industry and where it can go from here. Because late last week, we reported the news that the Australian wool clip was forecast to continue to decline in the coming year. It's expected to drop another 8.4%. That's the lowest recorded level since around 1922. In South Australia and WA, the reduction is forecast for 18.4%. Now, the Australian wool forecast committee says this is partly down to drought, cost of production and farmers leaving the industry. Let's get some South Australian industry perspective on this. Rod Miller is the South Australian manager of the Australian Wool Network. Rod, thank you for joining me on the Country Hour.
Thank you, Selena.
So we had these latest figures come out towards the end of last week, and it doesn't paint a pretty picture for the forecast for wool production. When you hear those sorts of figures, 8.4 nationally, 18.4 for South Australia and WA, I mean, does that sort of sit with what you've seen coming through with wool of recent times?
Oh, absolutely it does. Absolutely it does. And, you know, I guess top of mind for us here in South Australia is just the extent of this current drought, this long dry period, which extends across into Western Victoria and parts of Tasmania. So that's probably the single biggest negative impact for us. So obviously producers have lightened off their numbers. The excessive prolonged feeding cost is the proverbial straw breaking this camel's back. So I'm living this one every day. There's no doubt about that. And of course, we've got the Western Australian situation, Selena, with a phasing out of the live export. So there'll be significant, you know, probably 20 to 30% decrease in the West. And as a knock-on effect, because coming out of our last drought in South Australia, a lot of the ewes for rebuilding the flocks come out of Western Australia.
So a conflux of quite a few different issues there. We've got what's happening in WA, we've got obviously with prices and we've got tariffs, but the drought is really the big sticking point as far as South Australia goes.
Yep. Yep, if we didn't have that, we'd be much more comfortable about the future all round, and the drought will finish one day. But, I mean, we're going into the second year now, and if you're feeding out sheep over 14 or 15 months continually, let alone the actual cost of it, it's a real groundhog day for these producers at the moment. And so that's squeezing the profit margin. So wool prices alone aren't the major negative driving this decrease in production, but with higher input costs, you include shearing as well, and the feed costs, it's just soaking up all the profit margin and taking a lot of the fun out of it.
Yeah, as I say, feed costs, water, carding, all those sorts of things, they don't come cheap.
No, they don't. But what that is also doing is feeding in a specific drought-affected wool type into the market. So we've got a low supply market. We've got no increase in demand globally through what's happening in China and Europe, but we've got an oversupply of drought-affected wool types. So we're seeing in South Australia, we're talking wool types which traditionally would be in an AWEX ID, like an MF4 or an MF5. So they're going into lower yielding MF6s and MF7s, which means the actual amount of pure wool in these lines and 53 ams is just sitting on 50%, and the rest is dirt and sand and burr. And containment feeding increases that as well. So we have an oversupply of drought wool types, and they're all finer in micron too.
What sort of sentiment, what sort of feeling are you getting? I mean, you're out there every day speaking to producers. Mm. What sort of sentiments and feelings are you getting amongst those that you're out there speaking to?
Yeah, well, it's pretty tough. I'm having a lot of tough conversations. You know, sort of the reality of coming into wool sales, as we do every week, and just seeing the prices based on appraisals that we provide to clients, as other brokers do, and then opening up some really tough conversations. And it's where, as a wool broker, we become a counsellor to a degree, because people are really, really concerned about the future, particularly because it hasn't rained yet, and it doesn't look like raining anytime soon. Now, look, if we had a decent rain through, that would change that mindset. But I think it's the lack of seeing that, that immediate future turning around with the reality now of low wool types and low wool prices and high cost. You put all that together, it's quite a negative sentiment all round, and a worry.
I was listening into an interview with Stephen Hill, the chair of the Australian Wool Forecasting Committee, last week, where he was going through this forecast and the figures, and he feels like the industry's hit a natural floor, which is, I guess, a nice way of saying can't get much worse. Only way from here is up. Do you sort of feel maybe that way too? I mean, can it get much worse? Can it only get better from here, hopefully, especially once it rains?
I agree. Yes, generally, yes. But, I mean, I say to my clients and wool growers that the wool market will take off one day, but how long is the runway? And the runway's been extended by what Trump and US are doing to China. Now, China take 85% of our wool. So the Chinese manufacturing, production and export figures are the lowest since COVID-19. High youth unemployment. So we totally, almost totally rely on what happens in China. So those fundamental changes in China are not going to turn around quickly. They will one day, but not quickly. And ongoing effects through Europe, high energy costs, basically means consumers don't feel wealthy enough to go and buy nice clothes.
Rod, in terms of the decisions people are making about their flocks, I mean, what sort of do you see going forward then from here?
Yes, well, a generally lightening off of numbers just for the pressure of feed costs, et cetera, and no grass, but definitely making a transition phase to more meat production. So keeping a nucleus of merino ewes and putting terminal sires over, which is a tried and proven way for profitability as far as increasing lamb and meat production. And it also allows those producers, and that's very common down in the southeast where I am this morning, what will happen so they won't run weathers. But when the prices do come back up, they can quickly increase their merino wool production quite quickly. So that's a very good and relevant strategy for the future.
Yeah, depending on what you're producing, I mean, are all the prices at the moment, is there some fluctuation that you're seeing in there? Are there still some getting good prices?
Yeah, that's a very good question, because we look at the big picture and sort of how gloomy it feels. But, you know, for example, you look at 21 Micron, which is very relevant to South Australia. They're enjoying the best prices in 5 years, sitting, has been over 1,400 clean and slightly under. So they are equal and the best prices in a five-year period. So if you've got a heavy cutting Merino at 20.5 to 21 micron, and that's relevant to the pastoral situation, and lower input costs in general, so they're going okay. And the crossbred prices, you know, between 27 and 30 micron, they have improved considerably over the last 18 months. So with, you know, good meat prices and reasonable crossbred wool prices, those segments are actually doing not as bad, or doing okay, I guess.
Right, well, I guess the upshot, at the end of the day, is it just for those who can hang in there, it will turn around, it's just a matter of when?
Yes, absolutely, and that sounds tough, but that's the situation as I see, and if you love growing wool and are passionate about wool and sheep, that's what you should do. I mean, lots of people take a different view and take a more pragmatic business view, and we'll move out of merinos into sheep, into meat breeds. And that's quite situational on what type of country you have too. So, but yes, and I guess also a lot of businesses face these cycles too, other than farming. So it's not unique to wool growing industry. That's what people do. They concentrate on being better at what they do and ride it out.
Rod, thank you very much for joining us on the Country Hour today. Do appreciate your time. Thank you.
Good. No, my pleasure. Thank you, Selena.
Rod Miller, the South Australian manager of the Australian Wool Network. It is 26 minutes past 12 here on the Country Hour, and you're with Selena Green on this Monday. Let's head to the Weather Bureau now and say hello to Mark Analak. Hi, Mark.
Good afternoon, Selena.
It doesn't feel like May to me today.
No, we've had some pretty warm temperatures over the weekend, and those warm temperatures continuing today with maximum temperatures this afternoon reaching into the mid to high 20s again right across the state, really. We've got a freshening northwesterly flow, particularly over agricultural areas today, and that's ahead of a sort of a southwesterly wind change that's making its way across the far west today, and then will continue across agricultural areas over the next couple of days. We'll see the winds gradually shifting around to southwesterly again. At the moment, the pressure pattern has a high pressure system over the Tasman Sea, another high pressure system over the Indian Ocean, and between the two, we've got a ridge of high pressure just hovering over the northern parts of South Australia. Beaches to just move up onto the southern coast, giving us these wind changes over the next couple of days. But warm conditions today. Again, we do have a total fire ban out for the lower southeast with extreme fire danger rating for the rest of today. And we're also seeing high fire danger ratings across many districts over the agricultural areas today as well. Tomorrow we'll see the tail end of the first of many cold fronts moving over the southern parts of the state. So a subtle wind change may bring some light shower activity to the southern coasts later tomorrow. But as we move into Wednesday, the whole wind shift is towards more of a southwesterly flow, so that'll help to push some more showers onto our southern coast. So if anything, Wednesday morning looks like our best chance at picking up some showers about the southern coastal districts or southern coastal fringes this week. Once that goes past, though, that high pressure system over the Indian will jump into the Bight, and that'll bring stable dry conditions to our state for the latter part of this week. As that high pressure system moves into the Bight later in the week, we'll have the cooler temperatures over our state, so clear skies at night will allow for some cold nights again later this week, with minimum temperatures getting down to the low single figures. So there is a slight risk of some frost perhaps for central and eastern agricultural districts later this week. Just a light frost, I would think, at this stage. But then as that high-pressure system drifts across later in the weekend, and later in the weekend we'll see those temperatures start to rise again. So all in all, it looks like another fairly dry week ahead for us. In terms of rainfall totals, I think most of the showers will be confined to maybe the southern coastal fringes, maybe extending over the lower southeast. But again, rainfall totals are expected to be less than a couple of millimetres, with some very localised totals of up to 5 millimetres about maybe the Fleurieu Peninsula or lower southeast coast, western parts of Kangaroo Island, that sort of thing. So no good news there on the rainfall front. Selena?
Yeah, we just had this text come in from Joe. Mark, he says, hi, Selena, can Mark at the Bureau please tell us when the most decent chance of a rainfall event is? Well, not in the short
not
term.
Not rainfall, and, no.
Nothing approaching that. No.
In fact, we look at the longer-term models available on other sites that we see, and it doesn't look good for next week either. So it's an extended period of dry conditions across our state.
Yeah, certainly. I think most from what we've seen, indicative is pointing now, at least we might be hanging out till June at this point. It's not the short
term. Good, does it?
No. All right. Thank you for that, Mark Macanlack there from the Weather Bureau. Fortunately, not with some great news for those looking for some rainfall. We know there's plenty of you out there doing it. For those of you in the western inland parts of New South Wales for tomorrow, mostly sunny is the forecast for the upper western district. The overnight temperatures falling between 11 and 14 degrees, with daytime temperatures reaching in the mid to high 20s. Lower western sunny conditions overnight falling between 11 and 14, with daytime temperatures reaching around 30. It is 12:30.
You're listening to Selena Green on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, in a moment, we'll have a look at what the weekend's election result could mean for the state's livestock industry. I'm going to hear from Livestock SA in just a moment. And one South Australian farmer spearheading a campaign to get to the bottom of just how many sheep are out there looking for feed in this drought and what help producers really need.
How many numbers we're actually looking at as to how many sheep we need to feed before the season breaks and before that feed actually comes through, which, is now looking into June by the look of it.
Yeah, it is. That is certainly the indications that we're getting from the longer-term forecast. But is that your feeling that there's not enough immediate support, or do you think that the drought packages are hitting the target? My talkback number today, 1300 160 222, or that text line that folks are using at 0467 922 783. That's coming after we get news headlines from Matt Coleman. Good afternoon, Matt.
Hello, Selena. In the news this afternoon, South Australia's Liberal leader Vincent Tarsia has called the Federal Liberals' election campaign a bad campaign. In SA, the party has been left without a single Adelaide seat in the Federal House of Representatives and now holds only Barker and Grey outside of Adelaide. Mr Tarsia says the party must learn from the flaws of the campaign just gone, with South Australia heading to the state polls in just 10 months. The operators of two Vietnamese eateries in Adelaide have been ordered to pay more than $800,000 in penalties and back pay after underpaying migrant workers some as little as $15 an hour. The Fair Work Ombudsman found Viet Quoc May and his wife exploited 36 mostly young international workers at Mr Viet restaurant in Adelaide's Rundle Mall and a food court outlet in the Chinatown precinct. A federal court judge described the couple's conduct as calculated and dishonest. And police say a 39-year-old woman has died after a serious crash in April at Templars on Horrocks Highway just north of Adelaide. Emergency services were called just before 6 p.m. on the 23rd of April after a crash involving a car and a truck. The driver of the car, a 39-year-old Williston woman, was airlifted to hospital in a serious condition, and police have confirmed she has since died. More news at 1 o'clock.
Thank you, Matt. Matt Coleman there with the latest in headlines. So let's come back one more time to the weekend's federal election and that landslide win for the Albanese Labor government. Livestock SA Chair Gillian Fennell spoke with me earlier today about how she sees this election result playing out for the livestock industry.
It is a very challenging thing for the entire agricultural industry at the moment to be faced with a government which doesn't appear to give agriculture the respect that it's due. I've said this many times before, but without agriculture, society can't exist. And we're more than happy to play our part when it comes to environmental sustainability and you know, our emissions regulations and all those sorts of things. But if we are overregulated, we can't do our job of feeding the world. And we in Australia feed a lot of people, not just here, but we feed a lot of people around the world. And, you know, it's very unstable in a lot of places at the moment. We need that stability that comes from being well fed. And we're really proud to play our part. So I'm just really hopeful that this time round we get a bit more support and encouragement from the federal government when it comes to doing our part to maintain a good, cohesive, stable global perspective.
As far as Labor and the Coalition went, I mean, there was some talk around ag policy during the election campaign, but it wasn't really sort of big ticket, first and foremost, front of centre as far as campaign issues went. Do you feel like you know coming into this re-elected Labor government what their thoughts and feelings and plans for agriculture are for the next 4 years?
No, I think as far as that goes, I don't think we can. I think sort of everything's back on the table except for the live sheep exports out of Western Australia, which is going to have ongoing effects, especially in South Australia, and ramifications for the broader sheep industry of Australia that I don't think anyone's fully comprehended yet. When it comes to things like the big things that are really going to impact our industry, such as emissions regulations and environmental laws, I don't think we really know what we're dealing with yet.
Going back to live export, is this a nail in the coffin? Is this a done deal now, the fight to have that overturned? Do you see that being possible now?
I really think the only, and this is just me making an observation, that I don't think there's any other pathways through the government for this. If Western Australian producers and broader industry choose to challenge the decision in court, then that's something that they could do. In the interim, though, I think we need to really focus on making sure that everyone affected, and this is not just Western Australians, even though they are bearing the brunt of this and their communities will be suffering, everyone who is affected by this ban needs to be able to access the assistance that they require. And quite frankly, the package that had been offered to the industry was pitiful, and so, as some of the leaks have demonstrated, even the government acknowledges that, and it is a shambles.
Do you think that needs to be expanded outside of Western Australia? Obviously, that's where the greatest impact is going to be, but it is going to have a knock-on to producers in other states, such as South Australia. Does there need to be a look at some support for those farmers here?
I think there definitely needs to be a conversation and perhaps some greater analysis done on the impact of the industry at South Australia, especially when the drought does break in South Australia. Traditionally, we did look to Western Australia for cheap restockers, especially for merino ewes. But with that industry contracting, it will, I think, definitely have impacts on the capacity of South Australia to be a good, sustainable sheep-producing state.
One ag policy that there was consensus on between the Coalition and Labor, which has been committed to, is a national food security plan. Do you see benefits in this for livestock producers?
I think there's definitely going to be benefits there if we can have the open and honest conversation that over-regulations when it comes to the environment and climate change doesn't help us be the most efficient, sustainable food producers. And there's many links in the chain that can be addressed and many strategies that can be employed to ensure that we have more robust food security measures, especially around food waste and these sorts of things. But we really need to look at this as a whole ecosystem, and I really am pleased that agriculture does have a seat at the table for that.
We're waiting for this drought to break. Would you like to see the newly re-elected Prime Minister come and visit drought-affected parts of the country?
Oh, for sure. I think it really is important to, you know, it's a localised issue. It's a drought in South Australia, but for federal politicians to take a trip down to where drought happens or fires or floods or any of those sorts of things and speak with the people on the ground and have them explain their issues firsthand, because as we've seen a lot in the media, a lot of the assistance that is required for drought-stricken farmers, such as farm household allowance and all those sorts of things, are administered federally, and changes do need to occur to those policies. So they definitely need to come and speak to the farmers of South Australia.
That's Livestock SA Chair Gillian Fennell speaking to me earlier today. It's 22 minutes to one. Hello to Miles from Keith, who sent in a text saying he was listening earlier to the talk about food security. He says in his text, make it profitable and lower cost of production, less red tape, and you'll have 100% food security guaranteed, says Miles.
Get your footy fix live and ad-free with the ABC Listen app. Whatever footy you're after, we've got you covered. Called by ABC Sports expert commentary team. ABC Sports coverage of the footy on the ABC Listen app.
Well, a streaky bay farmer is hoping to gather a database of sheep numbers across the West Coast and Eyre Peninsula as farmers continue to struggle with the dry. Well, Susie Kenny has started the Save Our Sheep campaign, SOS campaign, has already had more than 100 responses from across the state. She's speaking here to Brooke Neindorf about why she wanted to get it up and going.
It was after a week of ruminating and planning and having the wording there in my iPhone notes and just doing some final tweaks on it after many, many conversations that I'd had with key people who could give me as much information as possible before I launched the campaign. And I launched the campaign because we farmers out here, including myself, anyone with sheep, cows, horses, it's looking pretty dire already, and we're at the start of May, obviously, and there's not much forecast for this month, not much rain forecast for this month, according to the Weather Bureau. So going forward, looking forward, it was really trying to gauge, the step one of the campaign really is to try and gauge how many numbers of sheep are actually out here, particularly in the far west of the state where I am, but also for the Eyre Peninsula. And I've also received people messaging in from other parts of the state as well. Yeah, just to gauge how many numbers we're actually looking at as to how, you know, how many sheep we need to feed before the season breaks and before that feed actually comes through, which, you know, is now looking into June by the look of it, so...
Did it sort of come about, you mentioned there your own livestock, it come about when you're standing out there thinking, you know, how are we going to feed our own sheep, let alone, you know, how is the rest of the state or the rest of the West Coast going to feed their sheep?
Not so much really, because we've been able to manage as sheep versus, you know, the amount of land that they're running around on, not too bad. So we will get through with the amount of stock we have currently. It really came about from, I had a conversation with a farmer a couple of weeks ago now, and the emotional toll that it was taking on farmers was really, the empath in me was really struck by that. And we are a very resilient bunch out here on the far west, and we very rarely complain, and we very rarely hear farmers speak in the way that they are speaking currently at the moment. And so that conversation with that farmer was then echoed several times over with different people that had either chatted to me or I'd actually reached out to them to see how they were going. And I thought, well, if this is the indication of how people are going, people are really starting to make some sounds about how much feed they actually have on their properties and the lack of support that we've received, it must be bad. So, yeah, even though we don't necessarily want to wear resilience as a badge of honour out here, it's kind of like gifted to us and then we just have to wear it often. We often get forgotten about. We're a long way away. And, yeah, sometimes it just is enough is enough, and we need to be heard and our needs need to be met somehow.
The state government announced that funding back in April, the start of April. What was the discussions around the West Coast when that funding came through?
April the 8th was the funding package announcement, and I think generally people were, you know, oh good, there's more coming, and they were feeling a bit more optimistic. But also there was some real frustration in the wait time that we've had to wait for any funding to be announced or any relief or help, because out here we started looking around the paddocks January, February, wondering and thinking what is going to happen if the season doesn't break till later. And, you know, time ticks by out here. And and then all of a sudden, you know, we're into April, where we had to wait for that announcement. And now, you know, it's now May, so that's nearly a month later, and there's been nothing. There's been no real changes, and the changes, the announcement, the changes of the package that have been made. The feedback I'm receiving is there's not a lot of crisis support. So it's missing the target in, like, currently, because currently we are in crisis. So yes, some of the other support packages, they will assist farmers going forward. There's no doubt about that, and that is needed. But what's needed right now is to try and get our livestock through till we get some feed in our paddocks.
Was that support package too late, do you think?
Yes, it was too late. Yeah, we started making noises in about February. February is always a terrible month out here. It's always hot and windy. And, yeah, about February we started making noises and nothing seemed to happen. And I don't remember, you might remember there was a few stand on the steps of Parliament, a few farmers come in from around the state and make their needs clear then. And, yeah, it just seemed to continue on and other things happened. And obviously, you know, there's many priorities within the state, but yeah, the sheep were looking around for feed then. So, yeah.
I'm chatting with Susie Kenny, who is a farmer up at Streaky Bay, and she's started the SOS, the Save Our Sheep campaign. What's been the response so far, Susie?
Yeah, so far I'm up to about 100. I've received about 100 emails from people. So I think I'm up to about 60 or 70 from farmers around the Eyre Peninsula, which is excellent. And then the rest from farmers around the rest of the state, which is also excellent, because it gives, you know, it gives a bit of a clearer picture, and that's exactly what I wanted, is a clearer picture of what we actually are dealing with in each area and a clearer picture of how people's stress levels and emotional states are, because as we know, farmers are susceptible to stress, stress on top of stress, but yeah, sometimes mental health can be a real factor in this current crisis. So yeah, so about 100 submissions so far, and what I'm doing with that is I'm building a database to be able to hopefully present real real ideas and thoughts from farmers with their sheep, with their current sheep numbers, and also how many sheep they've had to sell off since last year's drought, or, you know, to get through last year's drought and then into the current week right now. So it just seems to be like a, you know, time is of the essence right now. So, and I'm very aware of that. So I'm wanting to move really quickly. So hopefully, you know, the start of this week, I'll be starting to present information to anyone who would like to listen to me.
From what you've got so far, have you been able to tell what sort of numbers have sort of left the Eyre Peninsula in terms of livestock?
Yes, I think yesterday I did a bit of a count up, and I think there was about 50 responses yesterday. And out of those 50 responses, I think on average most farmers have had to sell around 1,000 sheep, and most farmers are on average also, from the responses, still carrying about 1,000 sheep. So yes, the responses showed about they've had to sell off about half their stock, and obviously there's variables within that. Some people are down to very, very minimum, and some people are trying to get through their breeding ewes through this season. So yeah, it's one of those things that it's going forward now into the next, say, 6 weeks if we don't get rain. And you know, we're hopefully we'll always expect, because I know that we've sat around the kitchen table on June long weekends, which over here we call Mortlock weekend, and we're still waiting for rain. Like, I can remember many of those seasons. So yeah, the uncertainty of farming mixed with trying to keep our sheep alive.
And Susie, the campaign Save Our Sheep, why is it so important for West Coast farmers, Eyre Peninsula farmers across South Australia, known as a sheep state, to have them still here in the region?
Yeah, well, it's still important. It's very important because particularly out here in the far west, we are reasonably marginal cropping. So we rely heavily on our sheep for our cash flow. And yeah, we're just sheep farmers out here as well as cropping. But it's just part of life out here as well. So if the sheep are gone from this area or reduced dramatically, to try and rebuild that is going to take years. And when farmers are already been hit with drought and reduced cropping or even zero income from cropping, in fact, at a deficit from trying to put a crop in, it will be really devastating, I believe.
And just finally, if people want to get involved, want to send through what they've got, how do they get involved?
Yeah, so on my Facebook page, I have a link, and I also have a link on my website. Well, my website is just susiekenny.com, so that's really easy, and it'll be easy to find on there in the link. And also what I encourage people to do is to just write in what they feel comfortable writing in, knowing that they can also tick a box that their information and name doesn't go any further. So it can be completely confidential. So I think that's really important to people, for people to know as well, because in crisis, I think people can not really want to talk about their issues or share their problems. And I completely understand that, being a farmer's daughter and a farmer's wife and trying to get through tough times myself. And so, yeah, I think that's number one thing is the email will be received in confidence and with compassion. And also I'm hoping to, yeah, as I said, gather that database of farmers and be able to, in some ways, almost build an online community, perhaps a community that can support each other. And you never know, someone might have, a bin of oats left over from last year that they're willing to donate or sell at a cheaper price to their neighbour. Or, yeah, the powers of social media. We can use it for good if we choose. So, yeah, that's really what I'm aiming for, is firstly and foremost to get the relief that we need. I'm aware of the squeaky wheel theory. So, and far be it for us to sometimes be that squeaky wheel, but there are occasions where someone needs to stick their neck out and actually put their hand up and say, right, I can do that right now. I have the capacity to do it. So I think also, yeah, what I will say is this is really just step one. As I said before, I'm very aware of moving quickly with this because, as I say, the days tick past and the sheep are losing condition. So, yeah, step two obviously will be to, find a way of actually getting the response and the relief that we need. But I knew that without the information for a start, it's just hearsay. And, we could ask for X amount of trucks or hay or all that sort of thing to come to the region. But if people had dramatically sold down their stock, that might actually be partly a waste of time. But yeah, so that was really step one, was to gather the information and then with that information, do something with it that actually is meaningful. And I'm really determined to cut through bureaucracy and red tape, because that's a lot of what has been affecting farmers' wellbeing a lot over the last 12 months, continually having to fill out forms, continually asking for help. And we don't want to ask for help. We actually want to be, completely self-responsible, which is what farmers are in general. So it's a big thing to actually have to go through this process and feel like you're asking or relying on charities to prop you up or support you. But at the end of the day, it's not really about individuals' financial positions and things like that at the moment. It's about the crisis of feeding our livestock.
That is Streaky Bay farmer Susie Kenny, and she was speaking there to Brooke Neindorf for susiekenny.com, is where you can find that SOS campaign if you're interested in being part of it. Right now, it is 8:08, and you're with Selena Green.
New from ABC Music.
Chart-topping Australian country music star Travis Collins returns with The Band Album. Out now at abc.net.au/abcmusic.
This is the Country Hour on ABC Radio South Australia and Broken Hill.
Well, in a good news story to round out the day, dozens of bandicoots, bilbies and quolls have been released into the wilds of far west New South Wales. It's part of the Wild Desert Project north of Broken Hill. It's trying to teach the animals to adapt to predators by releasing them into a 100 square kilometre area alongside a small and controlled number of feral cats. Ecologist Rebecca West says they've had big wins by building safe havens, and this is the next step to introducing the species to bigger landscapes.
Is if you can actually get these animals to live with really low densities of feral cats, they get the opportunity to learn what they are, and then they can start to live and survive with feral cats beyond the fences. And so that's a real key point for wild deserts. We have this area, we call it our wild training zone, i.e. we are training them for the wild, because we have, you know, cats in the landscape right across Australia. We're not going to fence in the whole of Australia to protect our threatened species from them. And so this is a way to actually achieve that coexistence where we've got our native threatened species living with controlled densities of cats.
And how are some of these species doing in this wild training zone at the moment? Not just the ones you've just released, but the ones previously in 2024 as well.
So it's been really exciting for our team to see the success of these releases into our training zone area, so beyond the fence. We've had a few groups of western quolls that we released last year, and we've actually now started to detect new individuals. So that means they've been born and bred here at Wild Deserts, and they've grown up in that environment, and they've now reached independence, and they're running around, which is, you know, I guess a fantastic mark of success for our project. And we're really hoping now that we see that next generation have those predator smarts, and they're able to survive even better and breed the next generation in the presence of these feral predators. And we've also seen the same success with our bilby releases. So our bilbies are literally booming out there, running around all over the place. It's hard to find an area of track where you can't see bilby footprints that have run along the night before, and they're digging the soil out there. So they're really sort of taking over that desert landscape that they've been gone from for so long.
And what impact does have reintroducing these species to that desert landscape have for the environment itself?
So we know that our deserts really rely on these sort of species. So we often call them ecosystem engineers. Most of them dig for their food, or they use burrows to live in. And so all of that really helps with soil turnover. So where we have these species, we see healthier environments. We get more nutrient mixing. We get higher rates of seedling germination, things like grass growth, because they're turning over the nutrient, capturing seeds, capturing water with their little digging pits. And so you start to see that whole ecosystem revive. If you've got more grass, you have more invertebrates, you've got more seeds for things like birds and small mammals to eat and for reptiles to hide in. And so we're really starting to see those ecosystem changes now in some of the other work we do, where we actually monitor what happens to these other species when we return things like the bilby. And we're seeing 5 times the number of small mammals inside the fenced areas in comparison to outside, showing just how important these areas are for these species.
And what are the next steps ahead then?
Well, we're a pretty ambitious team, so we're really hoping that we're going to be able to see the golden bandicoot start to survive beyond the fence. So our plan is to do a number of releases over the next few months. So we've just released our first 100 golden bandicoots beyond the fence, and they're doing really, really well. And then I guess we're hoping that we're going to be able to learn, take these lessons and apply them to other places, potentially moving further beyond the fence, and also being able to give this information to other sites that are trying to do the same thing, so that we can really start to see these species out across our broader landscapes.
And is it exciting for you as well to be a part of this project? You've been part of it for pretty much since its inception. But, I mean, what does it mean to you personally? You're there day in, day out.
Yeah, someone who visited this week said, well, you seem excited. And I said to them, this is a genuine excitement for me. It's the reason that I actually came to the Wild Deserts Project. Like you mentioned, we've been here for nearly 8 years, and we're just getting to do the stuff that I guess attracted us to come and take on this project, because I believe it's the next step for us in terms of reintroduction biology, or trying to improve the ability to get these species to be here for future generations to enjoy. I think we really need to try these sort of out-of-the-box ideas, develop them further, so that we're not relying on lots and lots of fence safe havens into the future.
Rebecca West there, ecologist working with the Wild Desert Project, and she was speaking to Bill Ormond. And there's lots more to read on this and some absolutely gorgeous pics from out in the field. If you head to the ABC Broken Hill website, you can find it there. It's almost time for the 1 o'clock news. Just enough time for me to let you know that nominations are now open for South Australia's next Ag Town of the Year. This is now in its 7th year, the Ag Town of the Year Award. And it's all about recognising towns that embrace their farming culture and display the foresight, resilience and spirit unique to our regional and rural communities here in South Australia. So the winning town gets an entrance sign recognising their achievement, a certificate and trophy presented by the Minister for Primary Industries. There'll also be funding for a community event and sign unveiling to celebrate the town's achievement and a double page feature in SA Life magazine. Of course, last year's winner, Panola, for 2024. We've had previous winners also in Woodner, Maipalonga, Kimber, Pinneroo and Cleve. So nominations, as I said, are now open for the 2025 Ag Town of the Year, and you can go to agtown.com.au and get the nominations in, but you've got until the 21st of May, so get cracking. Finalists will be announced in August. The winner will be announced at the South Australian Regional Showcase Awards later this year. That's it for me. Thanks so much for your company. I'll be back tomorrow at noon for more Country Hour. It's just coming up to 1 o'clock, and don't forget, you can go back and listen to anything you've missed on the ABC Listen app.
Don't fight the static. Hear ABC local radio crystal clear on the ABC Listen app. Download now.
Discover more great ABC podcasts, live radio, and exclusives on the ABC Listen app.